The Precinct Omega Weekly Podcast is supported by Horizon Wars Zero Dark, sci-fi skirmish war games in a fallen earth. Visit Wargame Vault at wargamevault.com and search for Zero Dark.
It's Friday the 23rd of April. My name is Roby Jenkins.
And my name is Bernard.
And this is the news.
Stand by for incoming intelligence.
Minotaur Gaming has released a Kickstarter for the Rightful Ruler. This is an AR tool for unit and effect markers on the physical tabletop and, as the name implies, for a ruler tool that will accurately measure distances to a tenth of an inch. At first, the funding goal of 65,000 Hong Kong dollars, or just over £6,000, looks decidedly modest, until you realise that Minotaur Gaming has already released the tool as a free app and intends to keep it free. Yes, astonishingly, Minotaur is actually using Kickstarter to, kickstart something. They want to raise funds to develop the tool further and offset some of the development costs, but this is essentially a proof of concept for the AR idea we talked about with Thomas Rawlings of Auroch Digital way back last November. Mantic Games is doubling down on its recent release of a new faction, the Ratkin, for Kings of War, announcing two new factions, the Salamanders and the Halflings. Salamanders are lizard people, obviously, with a heavy emphasis on dinosaurs and reptile themes, with nothing really remarkable to see, but the halflings are a different matter. Whilst the previews clearly tap into the well-worn ruts of diminutive, portly part-timers, these halflings look like dangerous foes, and I am particularly taken with the general miniature in full plate armour and magnificent facial hair, who appears to be riding a giant Irish setter. I can see this mini being one of those that not only gets people into the faction, but into the Kings of War game all on its own. Privateer Press has announced new releases for Hordes, War Machine, Monsterpocalypse, and even Riot Quest over the last few weeks, but are silent on new things for their much-heralded leap into space opera, Warcaster Neo Mechanica. The Retribution of Skyra and the new Hordes faction, the Grimkin, seem to be the primary beneficiaries, with new solos and units dropping this month. Battlefront Miniatures has also added a new faction to their World War III 15mm battle game Team Yankee, with the West German army arriving in force, with tanks, air assets, infantry and IFVs being released this month. And let's talk for a change about Games Workshop. The GW fanbase is in a wild tizzy this week because of the revelation that their exciting new release, Warhammer Quest Cursed City, will not be restocked on their website, essentially turning it into a limited edition release after the fact. Let's talk, in fact, about how the larger operators in the industry support existing products, why they do what they do, and what that means for consumers and smaller enterprises.
Prepare for Intel analysis.
So first off, I want to say that Minotaur has nothing to do with this week's discussion. I mentioned them just because their product is something I predicted, and I'm totally not the only one to do so. It's really cool to see it taking form in reality. Being first to market in technology is usually the kiss of death for a product, but I think it's going to be great for the developers themselves, either because it will be a CV-defining creation that opens doors for them in the AR development industry, or because some third-party developer will buy the rights from them for a life-changing sum of money. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and Rightful Ruler will become an exciting new product, but my guess is that, cool as the software is, the AR hardware needed to make it truly practical simply doesn't exist at the consumer level yet. Anyway, enough about that, let's talk about supporting your products. We'll begin with everyone's favourite bugbear, Games Workshop, which is ironic because bugbears are one of the few fantasy tropes they don't seem to have ripped off. Anyway, if you've not heard of it, Warhammer Quest is a venerable IP that basically describes a dungeon-crawling miniatures board game set in a Games Workshop universe. It was an in-house follow-up to the Milton Bradley collaboration HeroQuest that we talked about here last summer, and the direct spiritual successor to GW's initial follow-up, Advanced HeroQuest. Warhammer Quest made a return to people's radars after the rise of the Age of Sigmar setting that wiped away the original Old World fantasy setting for Warhammer. The new game was called Warhammer Quest Silver Tower, and the broad outline is a light RPG in which players take pre-designed characters through a branching cardboard map, facing semi-randomised opponents and events that pop out of a shuffled deck. It was, I freely admit, hugely entertaining, spectacularly good-looking, and genuinely encouraged that kind of narrative, cooperative, skirmishy miniatures wargaming that I am unabashedly a huge fan of. And although I never got around to buying Silver Tower, it was on my shopping list for a long time. Until Blackstone Fortress arrived. This was the 40k version of Silver Tower, built on the same mechanics and design principles, but with a new setting, new adventure, and lots of new miniatures. I've got no beef against the Age of Sigmar setting, but I am a lifelong enthusiast for the 40k verse. So Blackstone Fortress immediately knocked Silver Tower off my shopping list. But I still didn't buy it. Why not? Because I already have hundreds of unpainted minis, and I didn't need to add dozens more alongside a game I'd never get around to actually playing. But that's the curse of the professional game publisher. Suffice to say, though, that between them, Silver Tower and Blackstone Fortress cemented in fans of GW a reputation for high-quality gameplay, exceptional components straight out of the box. So when Cursed City was announced, there was automatically going to be a lot of excitement. But that excitement was compounded by the fact that Cursed City looked a lot like an Age of Sigmar twist on Mordheim. Whew. Look, understanding the issues surrounding Cursed City requires a lot of backstory, I realise. Anyway, Mordheim was a fantasy horror skirmish game that GW released in the 1990s, when they were in a frenzy of mud-throwing, desperately hoping that something would stick. Mordheim was one of those games that veterans and older gamers loved, but which had very little appeal to the younger market that GW was targeting at the time, so it gradually slid from the centre stage into the hands of the specialist games range, and then into obsolescence. But like many things GW does, it retained both a hardcore of persistent enthusiasts who never stopped playing, and an old-school mystique that the same young gamers began to find appealing as they, you know, got older. And this was only reinforced by the success of Osprey Games' Frostgrave that was, in many ways, a love letter to what Mordheim might have been. In essence, then, from the perspective of GW fans, Cursed City was a triple threat. A great-looking experience out of the box, an homage to a well-loved lost game, and released with a commitment to medium-term support by Games Workshop, who publicly announced that they expected to be stocking and supporting Cursed City for at least 3 years. All of that serves to illustrate why the reversal of that position came as a kick in the teeth to a lot of people, but that reversal needs some unpacking. And I need to be honest here, there's a lot of rumour, counter-rumour, speculation and outright conspiracy theory involved in the story, but picking through it as well as I can with my business head on, it looks a lot like this. Games Workshop developed Cursed City with a 3-year plan that probably involved some small expansions, such as new heroes and enemies, explicitly tied in with Age of Sigmar's larger game, and at least one larger supplement with a new storyline. Then COVID turned up and threw an enormous spanner into the works of every company that has relied upon an uninterrupted supply of goods from China, which includes Games Workshop. GW has a long and respected history of UK-based manufacture when it comes to its miniatures, but it's been less good when it comes to its cardboard packaging, components and paper books, and a great deal of that, especially packaging and components, is offshored to China. China, of course, was hit pretty hard by the COVID epidemic, which reduced output from a lot of their manufacturing plants, and the international distribution network was similarly impacted. But it's not as simple as those plants not being able to meet demand. You may be familiar with the law of supply and demand, and this is usually framed as demand grows, so does supply. But in the case of manufactured goods from China, demand stayed broadly static, but supply dramatically fell, which meant that non-essential orders were cancelled, and in order to continue meeting their unchanged costs, the Chinese manufacturers were forced to raise prices for those goods not already covered by a call-off order. Quick diversion here. A call-off order, which goes by various names around the world, is where a buyer establishes a fixed price for goods in return for placing bulk orders in advance that are due to be delivered at agreed times. If the orders are subsequently cancelled, the buyer will usually pay a fee. The idea of a call-off order is that it allows better cash flow planning and hedges the order against a price rise in the market. But where prices are being pushed up by economic necessity, there is always a niche for those who don't actually need to push up prices to do so as well. These opportunistic price rises are particularly onerous on those who haven't established a call-off order. GW, I suspect, didn't establish a call-off order for its Curse City goods shipping from China and so got caught out with significant price rises on their planned orders. Price rises that would have pushed the total cost of a Curse City box in a restock beyond what their market research told them their customers would be willing to pay. At this point, we really get into the internal political weeds of GW, because at the point at which the purchasing team realised they weren't going to be able to restock Curse City after the first batch sold out, the community and marketing teams were already enthusiastically telling the world about their 3-year commitment to keeping Curse City on the shelves of Warhammer stores and independent stockists, and building up enthusiasm for the second round of retail orders. As a result, GW found itself caught in the position of having publicly promised something it could no longer deliver. And this is the point at which we see the crucial point in this whole tale. We get to contrast how a small enterprise in a similar situation would communicate with its customers with how Games Workshop chose to do so. A small business relies on a very tiny segment of a market population and can't afford to alienate them. This is why when Kickstarters go bad, you so often get to see publicly the detrimental effect on the mental health of the project leads, as their reputations and public personas are very much on the line when things start to go south. Their only option to save face is transparency, honesty, and sincerity. A large business, though, has a much more diverse audience. In GW's case, only a relatively small percentage of their audience cared about Curse City to start with, and most of that audience will have pre-ordered their copy. So the segment of their audience that they were on the hook to annoy was those who cared about Curse City, but who hadn't pre-ordered a copy. And this, I suspect, was the knowledge that informed their decision to respond to the problem by deleting all of their public comments regarding the future availability of Curse City and simply releasing a bold statement as follows. Curse City is sold out on gamesworkshop.com and we are not expecting it to return online. Many copies have been sent to local stores around the world. Please check with your local Warhammer store or independent retailer to see if they can help. In other words, we don't have any more, so stop asking. Games Workshop enjoys such a dominant position in the market that they can afford to annoy small segments of it now and then, because there are swaths of the fanbase that just don't care. For example, in studying this issue, I learned about the Iron Hands thing. I didn't look into it in detail because I don't care. They released a new faction that wasn't well balanced for the new edition of the game and then had to release a stream of patches to fix the problem their studio designers had told them about before they released, but it only affected a very small number of people within their fanbase, so they knew they could get away with it. People who didn't play 40k, didn't play Iron Hands, weren't involved in the tournament scene, didn't care. Compare and contrast with Mantic Games and Battlefront Miniatures. Now, I'm not saying that these companies are in any way more competent than GW. Rather, it's that because their markets are so much smaller and so much less mindlessly loyal than the GW fanbase, they cannot afford to screw things up. And so when they do, they have to be far more transparent and honest. But there are only so many sincere apologies a non-loyal fanbase will accept. Other than that, you just have to try extra hard to get stuff right. So, with new factions planned, these companies have been careful to take their time, get their ducks in a row, and drop new products as consistently and reliably as they possibly can. The Battlefront West Germany release is notable for the diversity of launch products. A starter box plus separate releases for each of the components in the starter box plus additional products at release, not parcelled out gradually over several months in order to artificially sustain interest in the new faction. Battlefront can't afford to have a potential customer look at the initial release, decide there's not enough to bother with, and get distracted by something else before they're up to speed. The new faction has to drop with enough stuff for any reasonable player to see the army they want to field right from the off. Mantic is in a similar position, although their development is a few weeks behind Battlefront's, and I don't expect to see Salamanders or Halflings much before June, especially as at least some of the kits are injection moulded styrene rather than resin. Like Battlefront though, their initial release has to be carefully planned to pull in customers in one go. And like Battlefront, Mantic knows that if they lose the attention and faith of their customers, they'll pay for it in lost sales. So, how does all of that explain Privateer Press? I'm super reluctant to throw more criticism their way because I have so much love for so many things that PP has done and is still doing now. But the steady drip-drip of new units, solos and mercenaries into the Warmer Hordes meta, it just doesn't feel well planned or intelligent. PP still enjoys the support of a fanbase rather more devoted than that of other companies, but there must be a limit to how long they can rely on their most enthusiastic supporters to keep spending money. And the dearth of new releases outside Kickstarter for Warcast and Neo Mechanica sends a pretty clear signal that without Kickstarter, this game is failing to win traction in their community. There is so much to love about Privateer Press in general, and its Warmer Hordes intellectual property in particular. I love the steampunk science fantasy setting. I love that the game has established a continuing story arc and isn't afraid to take risks with that arc. I love that they work with some excellent freelancers and pay fair rates to their artists and sculptors. I love that they've created a business model that feels international, yet at the same time uniquely American. But their whole approach to Warcaster made me concerned that PP was scraping the bottom of a pit from which they might not be able to escape, and nothing that's happened in the last 12 months has persuaded me that they have a plan to get back to where they once were, that is, punching GW in the face and transforming the landscape of tabletop wargames in the US. So with that in mind, let's talk about Precinct Omega.
Intelligence logged. Analysis confirmed. Applying data.
Right now, I have a very personal relationship with my audience. Most players of Horizon War Zero Dark are one of, or two social steps away from me, which means that either I have personally encouraged them to buy and play the game, or they've been encouraged to buy and play the game by someone I encouraged. At most, I think 90% of my audience is within three steps away from me. This necessarily means that I treasure my relationship with my audience of customers and players. It's why I receive and reply to rules queries in my personal email account. It's why I'm active on social media every single day, despite the detrimental effect on my mental health. People want and expect me to be there, so there I must be. For it to impact my sales, it doesn't even need for me to be less than 100% honest and transparent. I just have to be silent. If I'm not present for my audience, my sales drop. This is indisputable. And I've seen exactly the same thing in the lives of other small businesses in our industry, from John Katzer at Curasan Miniatures to Annie Norman at Bad Squiddo, from Chris and Rafael at Strato Minis to Ken Whitehurst for Polyversal. Our constant availability and transparency is a permanent requirement of success. I could probably even cite Ronnie at Mantic Games in that list, even though Mantic is a larger business by at least an order of magnitude than any of the ones I just mentioned. He has tethered his business's reputation to his personal reputation, and that comes at a cost. And it's a cost that larger businesses generally don't have to pay in the same way. This is why a smaller business building up to a new release is under so much more pressure to make sure things go well and correctly. Not only does everything tend to emerge from a single brain, but if things go badly, the anger and frustration of those let down by the failure are directed not at a faceless corporation, but at a vulnerable human being. Even if it's not intentionally directed at that person, if someone is angry at Precinct Omega for something, then they are angry with me. There is only me. Precinct Omega isn't just my company, it's my identity. Which leads to two conclusions. The first is for me, and this segment of my podcast is really for me. It's my chance to reflect on what learning I should take away from what I see happening in the industry and to publicly point it back at my own work to try to do better. And the lesson in this case is a harsh and unforgiving one. Try not to screw up. This is because screwing something up in my business doesn't just mean a loss of revenue or a drop in profits. It is a direct psychic feedback to my own mental health. Planning well and accurately and working just as hard as I can to make sure those plans pay off is an investment not only in success, but in good mental well-being. The pressure and stress I might suffer from committing all that time and effort to making my plans work is a fractional cost compared to the same stress and pressure I would suffer if they don't. And I say that as someone whose mental health is basically fine. Because the second lesson from this segment isn't for me, but for you, the listeners. A constructive criticism is sometimes hard for people to hear, but it's still valuable and worthwhile. When I have correspondence with Zero Dark players who point things out that weren't really clear or which were missed out from some book or another, it's frustrating to me because, you know, I feel the pain of having got something wrong, but it's good to hear that feedback because it means that I can fix it in the errata and next time I'll get it right. But be conscious of your anger and frustration. If you want to point your anger and frustration at a company, well, I can't stop you, but even GW is people. I've taken a shot at Privateer Press this week and I doubt that Matt Wilson will ever hear this show, but if he does and if he wants to tell me I'm wrong and that they absolutely do have a plan and they're going to be back up and punching heavyweight in no time, well, I am delighted to offer him a platform from which to tell me that. But Matt isn't working alone. He doesn't have to take my criticism to heart when he has development teams for PP Games who are doing large chunks of the work. Look, be kind is hardly a radical viewpoint, and I'm not saying this because someone's hurt me and my feelings are bruised. I just want to make sure that people understand that how a company supports its products depends a lot upon the resources that company can command. If I saw the kind of bile people spat at GW for a comparatively unimportant announcement about a comparatively unimportant product release directed at a small trader in this industry, I would be worried for their safety. So yeah, be kind.
Precognitive function online. Logic engine online. Stand by for predictions.
I got to make a new friend this week. I sat down with Alex Handley of AOTA's Shipyard, a 3D designer who markets and sells his designs via third-party printing services. I have some big thoughts about how the physical and digital product markets are colliding right now, and Alex definitely had some perspectives that blew my mind here and there. Plus, he makes a lot of really very affordable spaceship designs if, you know, you're thinking of buying a spaceship combat miniatures game at some point in the near future. Infinite Dark, 28th of May. Just saying. So, next week you'll get to hear my interview with Alex and some of my thoughts about some of the major challenges facing 3D designs as a viable product for the future. I'll see you then.
The Precinct Omega Game Design Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Precinct Omega to help us continue developing new games and creating hobby content for war games enthusiasts all over the world.